Hello, I'm Sarah Vine, and this is Sarah Vine's Female Half Hour from Mel Plus. I'm joined this week and every week by my friend and co-host, Imogen Edwards-Jones.
Hola.
Sorry. Why are you being Spanish?
I don't know.
Come mad. Coming off on today's show, one of Britain's greatest swimmers and one of the most recognisable voices in sport will be welcoming Sharon Davis to talk about her sporting career and why fairness in competition is so important. Are you a fair competitor, Imogen?
Do you know what? I was actually quite sporty.
Were you sporty?
It's quite unbelievable now looking at me. I look like a slug.
No, not true.
But in the olden days.
I always remember you were always quite competitive when it came to doing the splits at parties.
Yes, very good at that.
You're very, very good at that.
Particularly after a bottle of vodka.
When you were about, when we were in our 30s, we'd go, every party I'd go to, you'd inevitably end up going, look everyone, I can do
the splits.
And we'd all go, well done, Imogen.
Well done, yes, yes.
No, so I did do what was your sport?
Shot put.
No.
Yeah. I used to do the shot put for Worcestershire. And I used to dive for Worcestershire, as you know.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, yes, because you're always doing diving.
Yes,
as well.
Lots of diving. Yes, yes, yes. So, yes. Then two most useless things in adult life.
No, diving is quite good.
Well, once a year.
Yes. Sign of a misspent youth, usually.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Swimming pools in the south of France.
Yes. And nobody wants to see me put the shot there.
I was terrible. My father was a really good tennis player. He used to play for...
I don't know, he was too, wasn't he?
Got to the juniors at Wimbledon. Was just brilliant. And he had some notion that I might also be a tennis player. And that some of the most miserable memories of my childhood are of on the tennis court with my father shouting at me, usually after having had about four gin and tonics, while smoking a cigar.
Yes.
Me with my thick bottle bottom glasses, trying desperately to see the sort of other end of the net, trying to hit a ball, which I was not able to do on any level.
Also, there's something deeply depressing about being rubbish at tennis, because then you just walk around picking them up.
I know, it's all
for
you
hours.
Ever do. It's all you ever do. I did learn quite early on how to do that quite swish thing where you pick the ball up with the side of your foot in the tennis racket.
Oh.
That's all I can do. That's my sporting contribution. I can pick a ball up with a tennis racket to the side
excellent.
Of my foot.
Excellent.
Anyway, I think Sharon is going to be amazing.
She'll probably know a bit more about sport than
she
we
probably
do.
Will.
Yes. Yes.
Our guest this week is one of Britain's sporting greats, an ambassador for swimming, women's sport and fairness. Her new book, Unfair Play, The Battle for Women's Sport, shines a light on both the long-running and the newer challenges that female sports women, should we say? Are we allowed to say sportswomen?
I know, it's awful. We don't know how to speak anymore.
Sharon, thanks for joining us. Your book.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's so good.
Imogen's got notes.
Yeah, I've got notes.
She's got post-it notes.
Yes. You open more or less in Moscow. In 1980. So what was it like in Moscow in 1980?
At the age of 17?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very grey because obviously it was still behind the Iron Curtain, as you'd imagine. Yeah. You know, and I have memories of us being in Red Square and trying to step over the barrier and being marched all the way down the end because we weren't allowed to step over the barrier. It was a bit austere. They had lots of 50-metre swimming pools, but a lot of us were cutting our feet because the health and safety regs were not the same as ours, and things had been thrown up very quickly to try and get everything done. Food was a little bit non-varied. And again, we were told the local Moscow people had lost their food rations and their meat rations in particular, so that it all could have gone to the village. And so in one respect, everything was fabulous. And in another respect, you'd see a tractor driving down the centre of Moscow High Street, you know, and beautiful underground, not a scrap of graffiti anywhere or anything.
Clean as a whistle as well, that underground. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it was also the boycott as well. So the 1980s Olympics were boycotted by the Americans. So that must have been quite an interesting bit of pressure as well.
Yeah, the pressure was more before. So Mrs. Thatcher was calling for boycotts, you know, 6-8 months before the Olympics. And that meant that for me, I trained for 10 years of my life, 6 hours a day for this particular race. And the chances are I might not get there. So getting up every day at 5 o'clock and still going training when you know that that rug might get pulled from underneath you was very hard, particularly when we were still trading with Russia. You know, none of that had actually stopped. It was just the athletes she wanted us to give up going to the Olympic Games. And luckily for us, the British Olympic Association took no money at that time from the government at all. And so they said, no, we want to take our athletes. And so we did. But lots of sponsors pulled out. We didn't have the Union Jack. We didn't do the opening ceremony. We had to come home as soon as we'd finished competing. Yeah, so it was quite austere in lots of ways, but I was very grateful that we were there. You know, obviously for me as an athlete, you don't get many windows that come along every 4 years. And if you remove one of those, the chances are you might not get another one. So, you know, it was great. But in London, for example, we had 550 athletes. In Moscow, we had 150. So it was a very small team.
So you're 17 and you're in the Olympics. I mean, what was that like?
Yeah, but I'd been at an Olympic Games at 13. So, you know, at 17, right. I kind of felt like I'd won gold medals and European medals. You know, I knew what I was doing by that stage. Mm. And I would say that in those days, swimming was probably younger than it is now. Not for the good reasons, for the bad reasons that we sort of pushed our kids very, very hard, very, very quickly, and they burnt out. Plus, we didn't really have any support once they became adults. So unless you went to university in America, there was nothing for you, you know, to help you carry on. So now our swimmers are older, which is great. But, you know, we still get the occasional 15-year-old that comes through and, you know, 16-year-old that wins.
Or Tom Daly as well. And he was very young.
Yeah, you know,
he?
Tom was 14 when he went to his first Olympic Games. You know, so it does still occasionally happen if you've got, you know, great prodigies that, that come through very early doors. But no, I mean, it was really weird because I was the only non-communist swimmer in the actual Olympic final. And my dad had scraped every penny together to go. And my parents had never gone before because they couldn't afford to follow me around the world. But he'd managed to, you know, as my coach, to find enough money to get himself to Moscow. Didn't want to miss that one. And there was 12,000 people in the audience and they were screaming like crazy for everybody apart from my lane 7. And then I could just hear my dad clapping politely. But, you know, you do go into your own zone when you're in that situation. And if, to be honest with you, whenever I get super nervous these days, I always think I'm never, ever going to be as nervous as I was at that particular moment. Mm. You know, I knew that moment, that next 4 minutes was going to just totally define the rest of my life and was 10 years worth of work. And so the nerves that you have, once the gun goes, you just go into automatic pilot. But, you know, that leading up to it, if anyone had offered me a flight out of Moscow at that moment, I would have taken it.
So in that final in the Olympics, you were beaten by Petra Schneider by 10 seconds. And it subsequently turned out that the East Germans had been doping.
Yeah, she held the world record for a very long time. In fact, she would have placed on the Olympic podium for 41 years.
After. What?
Yeah. That's how ridiculous it was.
Oh my goodness.
They were giving the drugs to their young girls from about 11. So basically they were putting them through male puberty and with horrendous side effects. You know, I've never had a particular issue with Petra or any of the other girls. They were very much victims of the system as well.
Yeah. Well, they're 11. You can't, you don't have a choice, do you?
No. And they were removed from their families. You know, they were put in training camps in Dresden in particular. And, you know, they were wards of the state almost. With you. And if they decided they didn't want to do it, they would just move them on and bring the next one in. And they were also breaking amateur rules in the fact that they were awarding their families flats and cars and all of the sort of things.
Yes. That, you know, yeah. So there was an incentive for the children to be sort of sacrificed to this.
It was rewarding their families. It was really helping their families. So who can blame them?
What drugs were they actually taking then? Was it anabolic steroids?
Yeah, they were taking steroids, but mainly steroid cotrienol, which was one of the companies that manufactured that. They were the company that were awarded damages when there was a lot of court cases. In 1998, leading up to 2000, €25 million was actually awarded to a lot of these young girls for, I suppose it's child abuse, really, you know, what they would call it. But they all got off very lightly. I mean, the worst offenders got 2 years suspended sentence, you know, and considering some of these East German girls died, most of them are very badly medicated now. When I met Petra Schnurt, she just had a little girl. I think she was about 2. And Gracie, my little girl at the time, was only 2 months old, 3 months old. So I was still breastfeeding her. So I took her with me. And Petra was besotted with my little girl. And she'd been told because of her heart issues, she couldn't have any more children. So, you know, they paid a very huge price.
So the drugs put them through male puberty, effectively.
Yeah, basically. You know, and female bodies are not designed to have vast quantities of testosterone in it. You know, it does awful things to your liver, to your kidneys, to your heart in particular. You know, and these are the side effects that these girls now have. And many of them had disabled children. You know, the list is endless with the things that actually happened to them. And there was no follow-up. You know, there was no, let's look after them now. It was just, off you go.
Right, you've done your job, off you go. Mm. Yeah.
Is this particular to female sport, do you think?
Was there male doping as well? There must have been.
No, there was male doping too. But when you dope a male, the difference that you can make is very minuscule. Mm. Whereas when you dope a female, the average improvement they were making on a female athlete was 9%. Okay. So if you take away 9% from Petra's race, would have pushed her 16 seconds behind me.
Right.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
How do you think being cheated out of that medal has impacted the rest of your campaigning and what you're doing now?
Absolutely. It's probably the biggest reason why I'm doing what I'm doing. You know, that was allowed to go on. The IOC allowed that to go on for 20 years. And it was so obvious what was actually happening. For example, at European level, they won 90% of the women's medals. Mm. At the Olympics in Moscow, they won pretty much all but two races, first, second and third of the women's races.
I mean, just because you're how brilliant you were, but you managed to get second place.
Yeah, I was the only female British individual medalist in the whole of the Great Britain team. So not a single female won a medal from Great Britain, you know, against the predominantly the East Germans. In the swimming pool, I would say we didn't see any cheating in those days from the Russians. I think on the track, there was a bit more cheating going on from the Bulgarians and the Czechs, all behind the Iron Curtain, all doing the same thing, or all without any real scrutiny. Because, of course, there's no random testing in those days either.
No.
And it's quite easy to get testosterone out of your system. You can do it in 3 days.
Wow. Mm. But the Russians are still suspended, aren't they?
In some sports. Some sports are better than others. Athletics has been pretty strong. That's because of Sebko. Swimming was very poor in Rio. Right after Sochi, they enabled the Russians to actually compete. And in fact, we had British swimmers that were fourth that would have medaled had it not been for Russians who've been caught twice and were still allowed to compete. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with a country like Russia, you know, this is a state program, just like we had the state program with East Germany. So unless you punish the whole country, so they have to get their act into gear, nothing is going to change.
Can I just ask you about the sort of topic of the moment, which is trans female athletes? I mean, it sounds to me from what you're saying that basically what you're talking about is just doping in another form.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's exactly what it is, which is why I speak out so much, because I've been through this. You know, I saw my friends who missed out on medals and places and the whole life that would have been different for them had they been an Olympic champion, for example. And I do not want another generation to miss out again. And what I was asking the IOC to do from the word go was the science. And they've been so determined not to do the science, to base all of this on feelings, to base all of this on emotion. And it only affects women's sport. It doesn't affect men's sport.
You know, yes, because you don't get trans men competing against biological men, do you? Because they're obviously not going to win.
Exactly. They opt nice to them. They opt to actually remain and compete. If they want to be competitive, they opt to race and campaign with the women. So they might identify as trans men, but they'll still say, well, I'm going to race with the women. Providing they're not on testosterone, nobody has an issue with it.
No.
So why that can work for the women and it can't work for the same rule for the men, I don't know. But for some reason, probably because it gives them a big advantage to be able to go and race with the women, the transgender women are trying to race, you know, with the women. And that gives us a massive disadvantage, which is absolutely known. There's 17 peer-reviewed studies out there in the world, not a single one that says that you can remove male puberty. And all of these 17, 18 studies said that you can. And the last one came out of, I think it was Brazil in September of last year, so 2022. And that was after 14 years and still.
What advantages, just for the layman, what advantages does going through male puberty give a body?
So, for example, something like boxing, a male will hit 160% harder than a female of exactly the same weight and the same height. In Olympic sport, it's between 10 and 30% the difference. So middle distance running is about 10%. Swimming tends to be about 11% on average. Weightlifting is 30%. Things like high jump, long jump, explosive events, they're sort of 20-22%. Yeah. So the more explosive an event is, the more of an advantage there is.
Yeah, so even if you were in tennis, for example, that would make a difference.
Very much so. Yeah, and again, it's the height. You know, it's the fact that it's the height.
The reach, the length, the foot, all that stuff.
Yeah. All of those things. None of those things can be removed by, you know, suppressing testosterone for a period of time. It makes absolutely no difference. Lung capacity, the tension of your ligaments and the tendons. So again, women get six times as many knee injuries to men.
Because they're more flexible.
No,
we were just talking about this because the British football team.
Exactly.
They've got so many girls out at the moment with knee injuries, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, so that is due to what's called a Q angle. So because us ladies are giving birth, we have a wider hips. And so the angle between our hip and our knee is considerable more than it is for men. So therefore, that creates more stress on the knees and the lower half of the body. And therefore, you know, we end up with all these extra knee injuries. And again, it enables men to put more power through their stride. So in cycling, it's really quite important.
So why do you think, with the overwhelming evidence that says there's an advantage to someone who's gone through male puberty, why do you think people like the IOC or whatever, why they are not on your side, as it were? Why are they not reacting correctly, I would say?
Well, I mean, logically, sensibly.
Yeah, logically.
I mean, common sense, you know.
Yeah. Well, what's in it for them?
I mean, is it because of the sort of hysterical emotions around this whole subject?
Exactly that. And it's the lobbying power. It's the money that seems to go with it. It's the threat of legal action all the time. And it's the absolute disgraceful ability for the Olympic IOC, as they've shown repeatedly through history, not to actually support and stand up for female athletes.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. It's the sort of idea that women's sport is somehow less than, and therefore it's fine for these blokes to basically turn up.
Yes.
And compete as women.
Yes. Yeah. It's a form of misogyny, isn't it, really? You know, at the moment, I think we're seeing that in so many works of life. I mean, here's some really interesting stats for you as well, just to show you, you know, how unequal it already is. So, for example, in the UK, about 1,000 women earn their living from sport. Yeah. And most of those are lottery funded, okay? So that comes from us wonderful general public who are helping our Olympians. 11,000 men earn their living from sport.
Gosh. In America, it's probably a better living as well, I imagine.
Yeah, it'll be a higher living, you know, much better wage, particularly obviously things like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you go on the sports desk at the Daily Mail, it is mainly men.
Is it?
Yeah.
Just the lads.
They're very nice lads.
And then again, like, you know, advertising revenue. So in America, and we pretty much follow America, but in America, 1% of the sponsorship dollar and the advertising revenue goes to women. 99% goes to men.
I was just listening about the British female football team. Because they haven't got any they haven't sold the broadcasting rights yet for their matches, they have no sponsorship because they can't sign the deals, because they can't guarantee what exposure for signing up. And the male team have already got theirs all in place for the next two World Cups.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, you know, if you look at the viewing figures from the last, you know, European Cup, which the girls won incredibly, the viewing figures were amazing.
But also, I think the proof of the pudding is that my son is a Chelsea fan. And of course, as I don't know if you follow it all.
Chelsea
men's team are absolutely hopeless.
Are they?
And they're all paid £20 billion a minute.
Yes.
And the Chelsea women's team, who won everything,
are
just like, well, you know.
I know.
It's very sad the way that women like yourself, and to an extent me, not obviously as much or as successfully.
What, are you an athlete now?
No. in the sort of trans thing, have been sort of gaslit and been told that we're mad and stupid and evil and wrong and bad for asking politely a lot of the time whether it might be okay for women's sport to just remain for women. It's that misogynistic bullying that I find so weird. It's that sort of, you know, we're going to take your athletic space, we're going to take, you know, your professional space and insert ourselves into it. And if you dare to say anything, you're a phobic.
Exactly. And like I was explaining, that space is so tiny as well. We already have a so much smaller space.
Yes.
And then they want to come in, these mediocre male athletes who are now transitioning, want to come in and steal away the few accolades that we do have. Yeah.
What little space we get.
I love the fact that you just called them mediocre. That's brilliant.
Well, but also, that's what most of them are. You know, if when they're racing with men, they don't
win.
I mean, Leah Thomas is a wonderful example for us. And it is opening people's eyes. But I was trying to stop that from happening. I was trying to stop many, many years of women being penalised and losing their places, you know, to prove the obvious, that males are bigger, faster, stronger than females. That's why we have separate categories, right? That doesn't take an Einstein to work that out. So why do we have to have a live experiment with lots of women losing out before we realise that? You know, what we should have done is gone, right, we're going to protect the female category. You guys can transition, identify however you would like. We will treat you with respect, but you still need to race with your biological sex. And then we'll look at whatever these drugs are doing to you or what the differences are. But we're not going to throw women's sport under the bus meantime, which is what they did. And that's what I get so frustrated about. So that's why I wanted to speak out about it. But Leah Thomas, I mean, what, you know, Leah did was compete as a male and was 465th. In America, in the world, was over 2,000th, right?
Right.
Could never have made an NC2As, which is an American college championship, would have never made it to the championships. They transitioned, spent 1 year reducing their testosterone to 10 times what I have in my female has, all right? So nowhere near, you know, anything. And then went on to beat three Olympic silver medalists from America at the NC2As.
Have you spoken to the women who've been beaten and what do they say?
So Riley Gaines is a very outspoken American. A lot of them have been very badly blackmailed. I mean, you've got to remember, they were also forced to change with this person who, you know, is still totally male. There is no change of genitalia whatsoever. And they were being forced to change with this person, which is against the law in America. However, for some reason, it doesn't apply when you just say, I identify. And they were told that they wouldn't get jobs, that they would have to leave the university. This is Pennsylvania University. They were threatened very, very badly. So Riley finished her university degree. She was based down in Florida. She's a Floridian. I think that that gave her strength as well to be vocal. And she's fighting very hard in America and you know, getting a lot more opportunity to speak. Because one of our biggest problems was even just getting the opportunity to speak. Mm. Just to present the truth, to present the science, to have the debate. You know, we would be shouted down and called names literally to try and shut everybody up.
It's also, it is, I'm afraid, classic male behaviour. You're a woman, I don't like what you're saying, yeah. So I'm going to shout at you and push you around because yes. I'm bigger and stronger and louder than you. Mm. And that's extraordinary when you think about it because they're trying to be women. Mm. So if you're trying to be a woman, at least try and yes. behave like one and yes. be nice.
Pick up your knitting and sit down.
But where do you think we are now? I think we've made quite a lot of progress.
We have. We've made huge progress.
Mainly thanks to you, I have to say. Mm.
Well, thanks to a number of people. You know, there's been lots of brave people now. But in the early days, I have to say it was very hard when, you know, initially there were very few people speaking out. And I wrote to the IOC and I got 60 of my Olympic friends, all of which you will know. Every single one of those people on that list is a household name. You know, big stars, all Olympic medalists or world champions. Only 5 of those 60 have ever put their head above the parapet. But initially, I got those 60 to write a letter to the IOC saying, please do the science first before you throw women's sport under the bus. And many of those were men as well. Again, not raised their heads. I mean, Daley Thompson is one of the few men that high profile that has spoken out. And that's also very disappointing, you know, because they know the truth. They train with women all the time. Mm. They just seem to go, well, it's not our problem. Well, it kind of is your problem because these are males. So, you know, come on, guys, this is all just about fair sport. You know, let's speak up. So World Aquatics now have done a very good process. And I think partly that was due to Leah happening in front of our face and people couldn't ignore it anymore. Thank goodness for Seb, because track and field has done the same. Mm. I think World Rugby was one
rowing
of
rowing has done it, haven't they?
Yeah, well, no, rowing hasn't done it.
No, not rowing. No, you can still be a bloke and row in a women's team. I'm afraid.
Absolutely. But World Rugby has. But, you know, they did that on the grounds of safety. They didn't even do it on the grounds of fairness, which I'm glad they did it. Yes. But it got to the point where literally they had their insurance companies telling them that you're going to get sued for millions if, you know, if some woman gets her neck broken, which was...
Do you think that was just the coward's way out for them? Do you think that they thought that was a cleverer, smarter way of doing it without any hoo-ha if they said on the grounds of safety?
Do you know, I've got to the point now where I don't care how they do it.
I agree.
Safety should always come first anyway, shouldn't it? Mm. And then fairness has to be the second one. And then you have to work with inclusion and you go, okay, if we can meet those first two things, then fine, we can include. But if we can't include without losing the safety and the fairness, then we have to find a better way. Mm. So that's why I've always advocated for the female and the open categories. Everybody should be allowed to do sport. You know, sport has been a wonderful thing in my life. I wouldn't want anyone not to be able to do sport.
Yeah. However, so you think we should have three categories then, do you think? We should have three categories or...?
We should have female and open. So that's it. Oh. So the open category would be open. So the men would be in the, you know...
I could compete, theoretically, and come 7 millionth.
You could. A doggy paddle.
I could just do a little doggy paddle up and down the pool.
Yeah, I mean, also, you know, what no one ever talks about, because again, they're irrelevant, right, with regards to this argument, is transgender men. Where do transgender men who are on testosterone compete?
Where do
nobody
they compete?
Cares about them as far as like in sporting bodies.
Why are they so quiet?
Because they're biologically female.
Thank you. Thanks, Erin. So, I was going to say that, but you said it for me.
Yes.
Hooray. And what's really fascinating, actually, is world boxing, when they were presented with the idea of this female and open classification, spoke to their boxers, and the male boxers said, no, we will not box transgender men. Because the chances are one of us will kill one. We will kill somebody. We will hit them so hard. So you've got to remember, not only are they hitting 160% harder, they're also hitting onto a much more, I say delicate, that's the wrong word, but not as dense bone structure.
Yeah,
so our bone structure is nowhere near as strong as male bone structure. So if you hit 160% harder onto a bone structure, which isn't as sturdy, you're going to do some serious, serious damage.
So the men are refusing to basically
box. So the men said, we will not box biological females because we will be done for manslaughter.
Okay, but biological males are happy to box biological females within a different category. That's interesting.
So, but that doesn't happen now. So World Boxing said, no, this is really dangerous. We're not going to do this.
Right.
Obviously, what we'll do is we'll support an extra league. So we'll do everything in our power for anybody that's transgender that wants to box. You know, we'll help them. We'll create leagues. We'll organise competitions. We'll support. We'll advise. but it would have to be a transgender woman on to box a transgender woman, and a transgender man would have to box a transgender man. And that is the only safe way for them, they felt, to go forward. So again, it's about finding solutions, because everybody wants sport to be there for everybody, but it has to be sensible and safe and fair.
What sort of feedback have you had from this book, and what sort of, because we
it's not out yet, is it?
No, but I'm just wondering whether you've had, you know, from your campaign, how
we're
difficult
campaigning
it's
to get
been
Sharon,
for you.
The Mail on Sunday is campaigning to get you your gold medal that you should have had.
Are they?
You however are. Many well, thousands of you, years ago
is,
it was.
Which is lovely. And it's and to be honest, it's never been a quest of mine to get my medal. It's been a quest of mine to get everybody's medals.
Yeah.
You know, that period in time is disgraceful. It still sits there. Records still sit there. Whenever they go, who are the top 20 fastest times in the world for the 100 freestyle, you'll still have East German girls popping up where everybody knows that those records were set on drugs, which is crazy. You know, so something needs to be done about it. The IOC, again, have tried to avoid it with every possible trick in the book, you know, whether it's statute of limitations, not enough information, you name it, every single one they've used, and every single one we can back and go, well, you changed the rules when it was for a guy, you know, 100 years after, to give him his medal, or with Lance Armstrong to take away his medals 13 years later or whatever. So we can prove all the different arguments that they're making are absolutely bogus and rubbish. But of course, they'd have to admit, not only did they, you know,
let it happen,
they not run the sport properly so that people missed out on medals that should have won, they also didn't look after those East German girls, you know, and that's something they don't really want.
Absolutely.
And what did those girls say? Because presumably you've spoken to them. What did they say about you and your medal? Would they like to give it to you?
Yeah, well, when I did a documentary in 98 and I met Petra, as I said, she was besotted with Gracie. We chatted, we showed her all the paperwork, which she obviously knew. When I went to leave, she tried to give me her medal. Oh. And I said, no, you keep it, because I don't want her medal. I don't want to take her medal. I would like the IOC to issue new medals and to change the record books. I don't want them to take anybody's medal away. I think there should be this period in history should be just recognised. There should be asterisks. There should be no specifications about it in the records. So I didn't take a medal.
How very moving of her to do that.
No, absolutely.
Did you cry? I'd have cried if somebody had done that for me.
You cry at anything.
I do cry at anything, but I mean, I would have cried if someone had done that.
Yeah, I more cried the fact that she's so poorly and that she wanted more children and that, you know, she's been kind of just left and she's just one of many, you know, and she's one of many that was successful. Imagine all of the people that they kind of experimented on.
Yeah. Awful,
you know, so Craig Lord, who wrote the book with me, his wife is one of those East Germans that they used to experiment on.
Oh my goodness.
So he has great insight again, you know, because again, if you can imagine, you can improve 9%. You can take a very average athlete and turn them into an elite athlete with a 9% improvement. So they literally were just experimenting with dosages, with amounts, with when they could clean athletes up, when they could take things out of their system. You know, I mean, the book is fascinating.
What are the long-term effects? I mean, what are they dealing with?
Well, like I said to you earlier, you know, heart problems, liver problems, sterility problems, deformities with children, early death. Andrea Pollock broke the world record for the 100 butterflies. She died from complications. So, yeah, I mean, fairly serious.
And physically at the time, did you suddenly think that, I mean, obviously they looked bigger, but were they sort of hairier or anything like that?
The male traits that you would imagine. So, you know, very, very masculine physiques. They would appear when we'd never seen them before. So we'd arrive at an Olympics and all of a sudden they'd have someone breaking a world record who had never come through the program, who'd never done junior events, you know, who'd never, we'd never seen her until the Olympic Games. They had very deep voices. So of course, you know, that shortens your vocal cords, testosterone, so it thickens the vocal cords, which is why males have a bigger Adam's apple and a much deeper voice. And these are things again, which, you know, there's so many young girls at the moment that are taking testosterone and they're not being told that, unfortunately, when you give testosterone to young girls, it's not reversible. Whereas if you give estrogen to young men and they decide to change their mind, testosterone is a stronger hormone. Their body will take over again and it will reverse.
Yeah. Whereas I mean, once you've given a girl testosterone, testosterone, you will grow a beard. Your hair will start to fall out. All the things that you get when you're a testosterone, I mean,
a bloke.
I mean, obviously, when you have the menopause, they give you testosterone because a small amount of testosterone is what all women need. You know, as we convert it into
tiny amount, isn't it?
Tiny amount. Yeah. But, and I think we convert it into estrogen anyway.
Yes.
But all of those changes are irreversible, unfortunately. Yeah, you will always have a beard. You will always have problems with your voice. You can't undo it. That's why I think it's so important that we don't give these hormones to prepubescent children. Mm. I mean, it's not okay to give them to children who haven't gone through puberty.
Well, we don't enable young people to make life-changing decisions about tattoos, about alcohol.
No, true. You know,
about getting married. So if we deem them as not old enough to make those decisions, why are we deeming them old enough to take drugs which will potentially make them sterile?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think it's really important that we understand this. And, you know, we know that unfortunately there is a certain amount of social contagion. You know, you've only got to look at areas or look at schools and see that some schools have vastly larger numbers than other schools, you know, and that's not down to, oh my gosh, there's a lot more transgender people who happen to live in that tiny little pocket. It's down to social contagion.
Yeah.
And so it's really important that we put the brakes on, that we give them a lot of support, that we listen, you know, that the mental health crisis in our young people is really, really worrying. But we give them support and hopefully we bring them out the other side of puberty where they can make slightly more adult choices.
Yeah, I don't think anyone doubts that there are a number of people who are 100% trans.
Absolutely.
And there always have been.
Yeah.
And the percentages really, you know, there's always been people who are trans.
It's been
trans.
Tiny, you know, it's been really.
But what's happened is it's become a sort of, become a much bigger phenomenon because it's become, in a funny kind of way, it's become a sort of another way for a young person to get a whole load of attention, to get to focus the spotlight on themselves.
And do you remember we interviewed the person who wrote the book about the Tavistock clinic and how the difference was it originally was young men who, young boys wanting to become women, and now it's absolutely the other way around.
Absolutely.
It's young women wanting to become men, and she was saying that she thought it was to do with, you know, how unattractive it was to be a woman in modern society and how difficult it was.
Well, we've gone back, haven't we? We've gone back to these ridiculous stereotypes. Mm. You know, that to be a woman means you have to look like Kim Kardashian. Otherwise, you're not a woman. And that's just ridiculous. That's not what being a female is. Being a female is your biological anatomy, you know, it is what you are, and none of that can't be changed. You know, your chromosomes cannot be changed. So what you are, whether you're male or female, is what you're going to remain for the rest of your life, regardless of what you do externally to it. However, how masculine you are or how feminine you are has got nothing to do with whether that makes you a man or a woman. That's just your personality.
It's just how you dress, to be honest.
It's just how
and attitude and
that's what we need to be more tolerant of. You know, we need much more tolerant
nuanced. It's become very
They've always been masculine women and feminine men, and that's completely fine. I don't think anyone ever has a problem with those things.
But it's don't we? We seem to now.
Yeah,
you know, we seem to be.
But also, there seems to be this presumption that if you're a gay man, that somehow that means you want to be a woman.
No,
you're just a gay man.
Yes.
I mean, I noticed the other day that the new term for lesbian is apparently a non-man.
A non-man. A non-man fancying another non-man.
Out of John Hopkins, that is, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That was so. Yeah. So women no longer really exist at all. We're just not men.
I know. Like, and again, if you look at even the National Health Service, you know, I get so depressed when you go online and they call women, you know, chest feeders.
Yes.
And, you know, ovary owners, and this does not happen to men. So if you go on again and look at prostate cancer, you know, they'll still be referring to people as men.
Yes.
It's only happening to women. Why are we letting this happen?
Do you think we're sleepwalking? Do you think that's the problem?
I do. And I think women, we're much more programmed to try to accommodate. And,
well, that's our hormones. That's our hormones. We've got all these nice, furry, fluffy lady hormones that are designed to stop us from killing our annoying children and leaving our
leaving our very boring husbands.
Our very boring husbands. And this is why I think so many people, women standing up against this thing, are all postmenopausal, because once you're past the menopause, you haven't got any of those hormones.
We have got a few brave younger ones, you know, Amelia, who does shop for us on the track. And as I said, we've got Riley in America. So what I want to try to do is to bring them together so they can have a voice. At the moment, we're not giving our athletes a voice. So World Athletics actually did poll their athletes, and their athletes incredibly, you know, by a very, very large percentage said, no, we want fair sport. But you know, it took 8 years before a governing body asked a female athlete what they felt about it.
Yeah, it's not okay, is it?
No.
It's not okay. Okay, well, Sharon, you're doing amazing work, and I hope the book does well.
So do I. It's very, very, very interesting.
Really interesting read. There's lots of things
in
there as
well. Yeah, no, it is.
It talks about the history of women's sport at the Olympics.
It's really interesting,
and all sorts of stuff as well. Just the challenges we've had, obviously the present ones, the East German era, the transgender debate, but the challenges to women's sport over a long period of time.
My challenge is just, you know,
to just to do
just
any
to
sport.
Do any sport, really.
Get off the that's my sofa.
Thanks very much, Sharon. If you enjoy listening to The Half Hour, why not visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you would like to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus, me at Westminster Wag. And once again, Imogen still not on Twitter, still locked out, still no reply from Elon.
I've
not
given
even
up,
a
no.
text message or a bunch of flowers.
No.
You've been listening to Female Half Hour with me, Sarah Vine, and the social media starved Imogen Edwards-Jones. Thank you for listening. Are you finding it much better without the social media? Is life better?
Yes, I would care less about most things. Yes.
Yeah. No. The trolls.
Yeah.